scenes? Make a mess.
Should I make a mess first? Well, how about, let's start with this. I'm going to show you, take a look at this. This is a map, and you can see in this map how over the last couple of years that the amount of parents that have chosen to opt out of getting their kids vaccinated for measles has increased in California. So these are parents that use the personal belief exemption to get their kids not vaccinated, so they didn't have to take the vaccinations. Yeah, how was that?
That was pretty good.
That was pretty good.
Those red clusters there that you see are more than 5% of the population. And those are just verbal claims. People who have actually said on paperwork that they are taking that personal belief exemption. A lot less people get vaccinated even than that.
Right. Okay. So let's start for like just the layman basic people that know nothing about science.
Okay.
People don't want measles, right?
No, you don't want measles.
You don't want measles, so they vaccinated us for measles. You've been vaccinated for measles, right? I've been vaccinated for measles.
It was called the MMR vaccine, probably. Right. The measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. And these sound like Victorian diseases, don't they?
Right.
Rubella. Who do you know that's had rubella?
Right, exactly.
All right, folks. David, you are muted, my friend.
So
I'm gonna step in and do that intro. Episode 39, Left Reckoning.
Actually, I think we're episode 40.
Did I mistype the episode? Well, look forward to that being updated after the show, folks.
Yeah, we'll get that fixed soon. I know we're very happy everybody's here. I mean, this will be a really fun show. Matt and I were debuting our new system, which I think looks pretty snazzy, honestly. But
I like it.
That means I'm driving tonight, so send all of your emails about technical mistakes to me. Matlek is free from blame tonight. We have a lot to talk about. We're going to be joined in a little bit by Maximilian Alvarez, someone who I'm very excited to have joining us on the show after a long while, the editor-in-chief at the Real News Network, and also the host of the wonderful show Working People's Pod. And he's going to be helping us break down Strike Wave, Striketober, the great opt-out. I'm really looking forward to hearing his perspective. And then a little bit later in the show, Matt's coming for one of his heroes. He's trying to reclaim one of his heroes.
I'm coming to save him. Russell Brand, Russ, good old Russ, as I call him. I'm coming to reclaim you from, I'm calling it, get him from the geeks. he's gotten in with the wrong crew, but his heart is, he's got a good anti-capitalist heart, in my opinion. And we're gonna talk a little bit about mythology, because he wasn't able to get, in my opinion, and I think in his, a fruitful conversation with Brett Weinstein and Heather on the topic. Brother, as I'll abbreviate. But we'll go into why it's actually important to talk about capital when it comes to talk about the myths that we live by in this world of ours, actually.
No, I'm really happy to do that because, I mean, we'll talk about it later in the show, but, you know, Russell Brand really does have quite a large audience, and I think is sort of prime for quite a radical critique. So I'm happy to, you know, just not like throw him away to the Joe Rogans and the Weinsteins of the world.
Absolutely.
He's a smart guy. Well, before we get to that, we got to talk about climate. Specifically, what we're up against. And, you know, we're preparing for COP26. We did a pretty in-depth interview and conversations with our friends at La Ruta del Clima pretty recently on COP26 and what that's going to mean, one, for tackling climate change, but specifically for Latin America. People should definitely check that out. And, you know, people who listen to that interview, we're not very optimistic about what's going to come out of it. But I've been thinking a lot about the way that climate change is being talked about in the media and the way that a lot of people are sort of interacting with it in the political sphere. And I've been getting nervous specifically about some of the slogans that we put forward on the left. Like, many on the left say things like, there is no solution to climate change under capitalism. And that's certainly true in the sense that whatever they do is not going to be equitable. We're already seeing this kind of patchwork and ineffective model for dealing with climate change. And there's no doubt that, you know, wealthy folks are already preparing themselves for catastrophe and are sort of hoping that they can, you know, have a golden parachute out of the end of the world, right? I'm not saying that slogan is not true in the sense that like whatever they're trying to do is going to be inadequate. But the fact is that we're already seeing the signs that they're at least going to motion towards action, right? And I think it's really important that we start to prepare ourselves for, you know, greenwashing out of mass scale and for also being able to come at these kind of inefficient plans that we're seeing from governments around the world and specifically the United States. And especially because we're out of power, we need to make sure because people are asking for action, right? I mean, we've been living through years now of mass actions of people demanding that governments start to act on climate change,
including workers of those companies.
Yes, and we'll get to that's why we support a just transition and all that kind of stuff as well, right? But I think it's just really important that we start to move past the just like we demand action stage to actually starting to put forward a bold vision. This tweet here from Fred Stafford, I think, really highlighted this dichotomy here. This is a piece that just came out in the New York Times about the Biden administration under Interior Secretary Deb Haaland is basically going to lease out federally owned land to wind generation companies, right? Wind power generation companies. And as Fred Stafford notes here, federal waters along most of the United States coastline will soon be leased to private developers to build and sell output of offshore wind. We're a long way from New Deal ideas about public power, sadly. And that, I think, really highlights one of the kind of tragic aspects of the moment that we're in. Like, in this kind of moment of clear crisis, right, where something has to be done about climate change, we still haven't been able to develop at least a public enough critique to start to even imagine what a different system would look like. And it looks like what is going to end up happening is that we're going to import all of the worst aspects of, you know, fossil fuel capitalism into, you know, green renewable energy capitalism, right? You know, just because they're green industries, for example, does not mean that they're going to be any nicer to workers or anything like that. That's why we need to have a just transition and we need to be fighting for unionized, workforces here. And this is another example, too, where this is new industry. This is industry that the United States government is going to be spending a lot of money promoting domestically in the United States. And instead of saying, yeah, we're spending the money and we own this, this is public power, this belongs to the people, we're going to go with this, you know, failed model of private ownership, which just opens up opportunities, one, for abuse, but also just needless profiteering while turning your back on the people who need these kind of services. And on this, so, you know, that, and I don't want to make this whole thing just a fixation on the green and renewable, industry, because there are much bigger fish to fry still, and that's the fossil fuel industry. And I have a couple of clips from something that I just have found to be so cynical, which is this podcast that Shell, yes, that Shell, Shell Oil Company has been putting out on the solutions to climate change. And maybe one day, Matt, we should do like a deep dive into some of these episodes because they're pretty grand. They're talking about all the big problems. But in every one of these conversations, they have a representative from the Shell Corporation there. And of course, the people who are, you know, speaking to them, you know that what kind of platform they're on. So the solutions are sort of like abstract, or they fall into this really, really dangerous kind of rhetoric around climate change, where dealing with climate change becomes a kind of like sense of, you know, community responsibility that is going to be mediated by like our own personal sacrifice instead of what it needs to be, which is class war, right? Which is to radically reshape the way that not only we produce energy in the society, but the way that we organize ourselves economically, right? Let me play some of these things from it because I think it's pretty rich when you're able to listen to the folks deep inside of the beast, and note who they start to point their fingers at, right? Who are the biggest problems when it comes to dealing with climate change? And this is an interview, I think, from 2019 on the Shell podcast called The Energy Podcast. And the person being interviewed here is Martin Wetzler, who is the Integrated Gas Renewables and Energy Solutions Director at Shell. So let me share this with y'all. Be patient. This is a new system for me.
We we are not yet there.
It strikes me formidable. Like, I thought people would be absolutely, you know, when you think about what Paris has warned us about, what the IPCC was warning us about, wouldn't it be front of public consciousness to say, you know, yes, you have to make sacrifices. If we want to be in a decarbonized world, we have to actually, you know, dare I say it, stop flying, maybe stop, change our diets, change the way we approach construction, all kinds of things. Do you think consumers are ready to take that on?
I think it's betchy. And I think one of the key issues there is that people want any solution to be fair. So for me as a customer to stop flying when everybody around me continues to do it feels really unfair. There you do need the government to step in and put carbon pricing in or put tax on kerosene and to take action that affects everybody in the same way. Voluntary action only goes so far. It is a small percentage of the population that's willing to make sacrifices if they see no one else doing it around them. The other point is, of course, if I'm an average car driver, at the moment, I can't even afford an electrical vehicle. They're still way at the top range of the vehicle cost. You can't buy a $10,000 electrical vehicle. They don't exist. So some of the customer offerings really have to still get into the range of customers to get to mass take up, and we better move soon on that. So partly it isn't there yet, and partly people are willing as long as it's fair and shared. And this is where politicians have a job to do. And they know what to do, they just don't know what to do and get elected again. And we've seen that recently in France, where even a moderate move on fuel taxes has sparked a huge public outcry. So I think we're all learning still how to do this and take people with us.
And of course, while governments try and work out how to grip public's imagination and make them okay with the other...
Oh my God.
So, no, I mean, and for people who aren't familiar, I mean, they're talking right there about the Gilets Jaunes movement, right, in France, where people were pushing back against a fuel tax that, again, these kind of taxes overwhelmingly hit working people, right, and not the people who have been profiting immensely off of this system. And this is not just like a one-off in this podcast. Like, that, a big part of the podcast is actually just trying to encourage this kind of rhetoric that the solution is not necessarily to radically reform our economy or the way that our, you know, the profit motive functions within it, but rather we need to be shifting the costs on working class people, right? And we also need this kind of, I don't know, like spiritual revolution to like feel, you know, worse about climate change so that we get into collective action, right? It's punitive, right? And the people who are being punished here are us and not them.
Yeah, I mean, we're the obstacle. Like, if they could only convince us that we need to do something about it. And the thing that we need to do, and we'll also talk about this in maybe a Patreon episode, but Orwell's wartime writings, when he's talking about the amount of sacrifice people are willing to give up because you're in a war before you really get upset. And the secret formula is make it evident and obvious and true that the wealthy and the most, you know, cared for in society are the ones doing most of the sacrificing, and everyone else is plenty happy to do stuff for their country.
Yeah, and you know, and just like the way that the question is posed, I think it's just so cynical, right? It's this kind of like moralistic things like, oh, we should be eating less meat and, you know, flying less, etc., right? Which again is, as Matt Huber, who people should definitely be reading on all things climate change, you know, brilliantly points out in Jacobin, and pull up. So I'm still not very quick on the draw yet, but we'll get there. Points out in many, many articles in Jacobin that this kind of rhetoric really protects the power structures that harm us. This is a great piece. Rich people are fueling climate catastrophe, but not mostly because of their consumption, right? And as Matt points out in that piece, it's like, yes, rich people consume way more than the vast majority of us. And like, look, it's fine to use that as a political, you know, weapon to encourage maybe some kind of class conflict. But the fact is that the most damaging system is capitalism. And the reason rich people are damaging to the planet is not necessarily just because of, like, I don't know, the excesses of their lifestyle, but it's because of the profit motive and the profit system that they amass their wealth through, right? And later on in that interview as well, Martin Wetzler makes this point too, right? Which is that he's asked, you know, blank, point blank, should Shell be just, you know, spending all of their money on renewables and, like, you know, creating the economy? And he says, no, because I have to make sure that my shareholders are happy, right? Which I think, like, and I wanted to bring that up, one, because it's like, that's actually true. And I'm not even like, I think there's plenty of moral arguments you made against these people, but I also think it's important for us as, like, socialists to start thinking materially about these things, right? Like, we could turn that guy's, you know, we could have a Grinch scene with this person. We can get their heart to grow like 10 times the size. But as long as their position is the position of managing that much capital and managing, you know, the business operations of Shell, they're always going to take that position, no matter what they even truly personally believe, and no matter how much that kind of spiritual development they go through. I think that it's really important that we start preparing for this, just because there's been such a long time, I think, when people do climate discourse on the left, that it's like, one, convincing people that climate change is real, right? And then convincing people that we need to do something about it. And what we're seeing right now is this kind of move amongst, like, the fossil fuel companies and through their propaganda arms to say, like, oh, look, we understand all these things are real and we really want to do something about it. And then falling on these kind of individual choice, this individual choice model of dealing with climate change, rather than what they should be doing, which is massively pulling back production of oil, right, and paying reparations to all the people that they have slaughtered and harmed throughout this, you know, couple centuries of damage under their watch.
Yeah, and it's funny how they move. They do this move of just, like, sort of fetishizing energy itself, right? Like, this is called the Energy Podcast. And it's like, mm-hmm. energy is just so important for, like, human living, right? And a guy that was on Dave Rubin's show is this exact thing. And it's like, that's not the problem with the energy. Like, all that is arguments for, like, this being nationally controlled and not up to the limbs of profiteers, right? And that's, right, like, anyway, go on.
No, keep going. I think that's exactly right. And, like, look, I think we'll need to bring on Max soon. So we're not I see him. I'll bring him on in just a second. Everything that we want to get to tonight, we've done lots of conversations with people like Ryan Pollack about things like just transition. But I really want to note this. And before we bring Max on, I do want to share this other conversation. I don't have it in my notes, but this is another Shell representative talking about oil and gas, and actually using this kind of, like, woke, like, don't leave, like, the developing world behind model for why we can't move away from fossil fuels in the near future.
And I think there is another. Hear your thoughts about what impact that side of the market plays as well. Jessica, can I come to you first of all for your thoughts on that?
Some 80% of all energy today is from some form of fossil fuels, and that's what's fueled tremendous amount of growth over the last, you know, several decades. And of course, that is not our future, and we do need to move away from fossil fuels as fast as we can, and we do need to drive for a low carbon future. There's still a billion people on the planet today, even with our current system, that don't have access, and we can't forget that all solutions need to address those who don't have access to energy today. But it is, you know, billions and trillions of dollars of assets, of pipelines, of ships that makes the system work. We have to all retool all of that, and that will take time. And that's a challenge, because from a climate perspective, we're running out of time.
I mean, that's just too perfect, right? It's saying that, like, we need to do something, but also if we can't leave behind all of these people, you know, and, like, I think in a really despicable way, actually trying to use, you know, growing awareness about imperialism and, like, underdevelopment on other folks, you know, as a way to kind of shield fossil fuel profits.
I mean, this is like how expanding employment rights to gig workers would be just like reproducing the racism of the New Deal. It's the exact same sort of cynical, fork-tongued argument.
I think that's perfect. Well, again, so we're using this new system, so we can't go to a break, but I will bring on Maximilian Alvarez in just 1 second. Maximilian Alvarez is the editor-in-chief of The Real News, and also the host of Working People's Paw, and the owner of a couple of really great fantasy football teams. So let's bring him on live for us right now. How's it going, brother?
It's going good, guys. How about you?
I'm really happy to have you on the show, man.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad to be here. Love the work that you guys are doing.
Well, I didn't know about the fantasy football thing. That's
interesting. Has David told you his team name yet?
Have you? Might have. What is it, David?
My team is Mike Gundy's Mullet. The coach of OSU, who's Texas is actually playing this weekend. Hook 'em horns. But we, as much as I would have loved to just bring you out to talk football, man, we also have stuff that's honestly much more exciting and encouraging, which is, I mean, you know, I'm hearing different terms for it, strike wave, striketober, just this huge increase in labor militancy. Maybe if you don't mind just sort of starting us off here, I mean, would you say that we're in a strike wave or approaching something like that right now? Or do you think we still need a little bit more time to talk like that?
You know, I mean, I guess I've been in that camp of folks who are watching very eagerly, very excitedly, supporting any way that I can, but, you know, understandably hesitant to kind of announce or join the chorus announcing a full blown strike wave. And I think it's important to kind of explain why. I mean, you know, one of, I think, the most basic sort of preconditions for calling something a strike wave, as opposed to just a number of strikes are happening at the same moment, think of like the wave when you go to we were just talking about football. Think about going to a football game. Right? You can have a couple of different people in the stands throw their hands up, but it does not become a wave until the rest of the crowd notices it, sees it coming, participates in it, and it becomes more of a collective thing. And so I think that one of the most essential sort of preconditions for calling anything a strike wave is not necessarily the number of strikes that are happening, but actually, do the workers at these respective strikes, workers who are engaging in these struggles, do they see one another, right? Are they looking beyond, you know, like their own immediate sphere? Are they taking any sort of inspiration? Are they learning any sort of lessons? Are they feeling more emboldened by what they're seeing happening around the country? Are they developing in conversation with other workers outside of their immediate workplace a sort of language to discuss the issues that are collectively grieving them? I actually do think that we are entering that sort of phase. We can, you know, kind of talk about this in a little bit when we talk about the quote unquote great resignation, right? But I mean, something like that doesn't just happen because tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of atomized individuals all just happen to feel the same way at the same time, right? You know, we've all seen this sort of mentality in the United States. You know, it doesn't have to be the wave at a sporting event. Could be that same type of feeling that you get when you are shopping, right? And, you know, think about like, you know, the early days of the pandemic, right? When everyone was running to the store and clearing out the shelves, holding, you know, arms full of toilet paper. And so then you're thinking, oh shit, like maybe there's not going to be any toilet paper, or why is everyone getting so much toilet paper? Is there going to be a shortage? Should I go get it? So then you run and go get it, right? So we've seen kind of the consumer side of that. Now imagine that that's happening in labor. Imagine more people are hearing from their family members, their neighbors, their friends. They're seeing on social media that people are quitting, that people are unionizing, that people in unions are striking, right? Imagine the sort of kind of collective force and, that can have on you. It makes you feel like you are less of that kind of atomized individual that capitalist society so often tries to convince us that we are. But suddenly you feel slightly more emboldened to say, we're not taking this crap anymore, right? Mm-hmm. You feel slightly more emboldened to demand what you know in your heart you deserve. I do think that there are more workers around the country who are kind of seeing the folks who are quitting, who are feeling the same things that a lot of us have been feeling, but they're also kind of taking notice of kind of employers being a bit on their heels. They're feeling like, you know, they're going to get more popular support from folks who are kind of actively supporting these labor actions. I think that those are all ingredients that need to kind of be part of what we might call a strike wave. It doesn't have to be something that is like worked out at a convention and then kind of, you know, facilitated across the country, across different unions and different workplaces and so on and so forth. It's going to be a lot messier than that. And it is a lot messier than that. But I do think that sort of self-reflexiveness and that sort of communality of the struggle is the thing that has been largely missing, but does seem to be growing at quite a rapid pace.
It's been fascinating how organic everything has seemed, you know, and that's ultimately where we need to get. But like, this is a response, and I guess we could talk about the Great Resignation, but just the amount of freak out you're seeing from people trying to get, you know, cut slash unemployment benefits, for instance, try to get people back to work. And there's resilience to it, is one of the things that's been very fascinating to watch.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, let's talk about the Great Resignation while we're over here, yeah. Right? So, you know, this is something that I've been thinking about quite a lot. It's something that I've had, you know, not just other folks in the media, not just folks that I talk to, you know, for The Real News or Working People, but family, friends, you know, people on social media kind of reaching out to me and asking about it. Like, you know, my, you know, one of my best friends in the world just, you know, texted me, you know, one of my oldest friends in the world too, texted me kind of asking me about this. I won't add him here, but I mean, like, this is something that is very much, you know, a phenomenon, right? I mean, I had written kind of some of this down before we got rolling, but I guess just for folks out there who are watching, who are kind of wondering what we are calling the quote unquote Great Resignation. You know, we are talking about this sort of phenomenon of record numbers of workers in this country quitting their jobs, right? People saying, you know, for a number of different reasons, this isn't working for me. This is no good. This is not enough. You're not treating me well enough. I know that I deserve better, and I'm out of here, right? So in June and July, the rate of voluntary quits was 2.7%. of the U.S. workforce, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. But the Bureau of Labor Statistics actually released new numbers this week showing that in August, that rate of quitting was 2.9%, amounting to 4.3 million people who quit their job in August 2021 alone, which is the highest level that the agency has seen since it started tracking this data in the year 2000. And I pulled just some kind of key figures, right? So in August, 892,000 workers quit, you know, food and service jobs and accommodation jobs like hotel jobs. 721,000 quit retail jobs. And again, this is just in August alone. 534,000 in the healthcare sector quit their jobs. And that's pretty staggering, right? And you know, there are so many kind of pundits and politicians right now who are trying to kind of like, they're wrapping their heads around this, trying to figure out what's happening, when I think a lot of what's happening is actually quite obvious. But you're seeing what I had always heard about, but I feel like I had only maybe seen once or twice in my life, which is what, you know, you call an employee's market or a worker's market. Right. So right now, I believe that the number, the official kind of statistics are that there's 7.7 million people who remain unemployed. You know, we can kind of take that number with a pinch of salt. And for the most part, jumping, and there are 10.4 million job openings, right? So there are more job openings than there are supposedly like kind of available workers to take those jobs. You are now actually seeing why employers have tried so hard for our entire lifetimes to avoid this scenario, right? You know, everyone who's ever applied for a job in their life knows what an employer's market looks like, right? That is a boss folding, you know, his arms, making you, you know, apply and kind of write a laundry list of your qualifications, jump through, you know, X amount of hoops, pay out of your own pocket to get certifications and stuff that the employer should be paying for, but they have the power to say, no, you should do it because we have all these applicants, right? We hold all the cards. It's up to us, you know, like, and basically how high you're willing to jump. That's what's going to decide whether or not you get this job. Now we're kind of seeing like the flip of that, and employers are losing their fucking minds. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's a good thing, right? And so we can talk more about like perhaps what that means and what is driving it, but I'll shut up now and ask what you guys think.
Well, I mean, I think it was really interesting about this resignation is, you know, the amount of like food and service workers in it. Like as somebody who was, you know, worked in restaurants and bars for, you know, my early, pretty much like the vast majority of my like youth, I remember very clearly, I had a boss who had would keep a huge binder with him. And whenever somebody would complain, he would pick the binder up and he would say, you know, these are all the, you know, if this is a problem, like these are all the people who want your job, right? And they would use that kind of threat of, you know, you're replaceable. I can get somebody in a second.
Binders full of workers.
Yeah, binders full of workers, man. I mean, but, you know, I mean, maybe not everyone is as dramatic of that, but people get that feeling from their bosses, right? That's a pretty constant threat in capitalism. And it is interesting to see that dynamic flip, despite the kind of lobbying that we've been seeing from organizations like the NRA, the really evil NRA, the National Restaurant Association, you know, to try to break these. To break these benefits, because you realize, I don't know, most people listening to the show are left socialists, but you know, you do really realize how critical the role, either the existence or the lack of existence of like regulation and you know, social welfare programs, etc., are in like this kind of dynamic, and any kind of shift in that has completely changed the rule book, which is why we're seeing such a backlash.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like you saw, so it's there are a couple of things here where we need to like walk and chew gum, which is admittedly, we need to walk and chew gum at the same time, which is admittedly something that those of us on the left are not always really great at doing, right? We tend to hyper-focus on one sort of mm-hmm. thing as if it excludes all other kind of factors in the situation. What I mean by that, right, is that there was something. There were multiple incredible and intense and sort of paradigm shifting things that happened over the course of the COVID-19 pandemic here in the United States. We'll stick here just for now, but we should not be myopic or overly nationalistic about this. But point being is that, you know, those extended kind of social safety net, that extended social safety net, those extended unemployment benefits were a lifesaver for many people, right? It was, frankly, in my opinion, very much inadequate, right? Compared to mm-hmm. what people should have gotten. And I will never, frankly, forgive the political establishment for, you know, so gleefully denying people mm-hmm. what they desperately needed over the course of the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, it is unforgivable. And, you know, like what we got here in the United States was fucking bullshit, frankly. And a lot of people suffered because of that. A lot of people may have had to go into unsafe work because the government was not providing the kind of assistance that they needed. They may have gotten sick. They may have died. They may have passed it on to their family members. So this had real like human implications, the kind of callousness that we saw from Washington, D.C., to say nothing of the quote unquote market and the solutions that it provided to people's woes over the past 2 years. Where I'm going with this is that amidst all of that, with all those kind of caveats, right, the kind of child tax credit like was huge mm-hmm. for so many families, right? We saw like these kind of staggering numbers where what is it like the kind of the collective wealth of, you know, like the working class, like rose like a tremendous amount just because people finally got some like actual mm-hmm. assistance from the government with these extended unemployment benefits. Like, and this kind of ghoulish chorus of, yeah, media pundits and Chamber of Commerce related pieces of shit and think tank douchebags down there in D.C., right? They knew, they could see the writing on the wall. Like they did not want people to have any of this because they knew for so long the business class and the ruling class writ large has tried so hard to keep people living so close to the bone that mm-hmm. we have no ability to take a step back and to actually ask if there's another way or if there's something else that we could be doing with our lives, because like we are always just kind of in that position of taking whatever crap our bosses give us because we desperately need that paycheck because most American households couldn't even handle an unexpected $400 expense, let alone a $1,000 expense, right? If that is the kind of precariousness that, you know, the majority of people are living in, even just the kind of, you know, moderate sort of support that people got during the pandemic, we saw the kind of, you know, again, paradigm shifting sort of result that happened there. You know, I have a book of interviews with workers that I interviewed during like the height of the pandemic in like January and December of 2020 and 2021. That's coming out in a couple months with Or Books, but I was since it's coming out, I've had to kind of go over it and, you know, reread, you know, all those transcripts and kind of remember who we were and what we were talking about in those months. And, you know, it really is just kind of staggering to remember and recognize that for so many people, an event as catastrophic and cataclysmic and deadly as the COVID-19 pandemic was the first time that a lot of workers felt like they had the ability to, as someone told me, this is the first time I felt like I had the ability to breathe. Mm. Like I could stay home. I could think about what I wanted to do with my future. I suddenly, you know, for as terrible as a lot of people felt guilt expressing this. They're like, I feel weird saying this because I'm seeing people die. I have family members who die. And yet this is the first time in my adult life when I feel like I've been able to kind of disassociate myself from that daily grind, at least far enough that I could stop and think about what I was doing with my life, whether or not I wanted to take this crap, whether or not I deserved better, whether I wanted to do something with my future, right? After confronting this experience of mass death, right? People literally confronted their mortality over the past 2 years. And I think a really, you know, powerful and existential way. And that can't be discounted when we're talking about the sort of things that are motivating people to actually kind of stand up for themselves and say that what the business class is offering is not enough.
Yeah, I mean, I see it, and it's extremely exciting. You know, among that too has been like, I think, a renewed interest in unionizing from, you know, all sorts of industries. I want to sort of circle back to what you were talking about earlier with like the concept of like a strike wave, right? Which was, you know, to me, it sounded like you're describing, you know, a bit of like class consciousness, right? It's like people sort of seeing in other people in other industries, like, okay, that's us, right? I don't mean to be such a typical leftist to like see something good and already like looking at getting worried that something bad's going to happen. But I'm seeing, you know, when you read, you know, Financial Times right now, or a lot of the business press, the big things that people are writing about are, you know, well, right now it's, you know, supply chain stuff, which has also been really interesting too, I think, by the way, because it has really like brought labor back into the public discourse. You know, a lot of people have just sort of expected things to arrive, and seeing that that actually requires people to do it has, I think, also been, you know, a factor in the kind of militancy. But there's the specter of inflation, right? Which is what everybody is sort of talking about as a reason that we need to sort of, you know, buckle down and pull these things back. And I just remember that pretty much every time in the United States, whenever inflation is brought up, that is just a great excuse for the government to pursue policies that are anti-worker, right? And to be able to fight back against that, we are going to need to start to build that kind of conception, right? Because as I always remind people, you know, people, there's a kind of like consensus among a lot of kind of right-wing economists, which tends to just be the majority in this country, that whenever workers' wages go up a little bit, that means that we have to deal with mass inflation, right? But I remind people that, you know, workers aren't the ones who set prices, right? That's the bosses, and that's the owner of these organizations, right? So we have to be able to build up our capacity to be able to, one, like have the argument, but two, to be able to have the strength, and the fight. But I'm curious, like, because you've been talking to people for a while now, you know, working people across the country. I mean, obviously the COVID pandemic has really shifted the discourse and opportunity, but like, were you seeing any signs before this of a kind of shift amongst the way that like working people were thinking about, I don't know, their jobs and unions, etc., before the pandemic hit? Or do you think that the pandemic really just opened up a whole new way of thinking?
You know, it's a great question because, you know, I don't want to be kind of dishonest there, mm-hmm. because I do think that, you know, something that has come through in, you know, all the conversations that I've had with workers, for working people, and, you know, for yeah, I think, you know, almost 4 years now, you know, I've talked to auto workers, talked to sex workers, I've talked to teachers, I've mm-hmm. talked to stay-at-home parents, I've talked to, you know, just workers, you know, across, you know, all types of industries doing all sorts of labor. And, you know, I do think that it is very much a common theme if you go listen to the whole back catalog of working people, right, that there is this sort of deep human yearning, right, in people. And I don't think that it's hard to say whether or not that is a product of the time and whether that is people have been ready for this, or again, if it's just a product of the fact that this is something that all of us deeply have held within us, right? Deep in our kind of souls. Like, we know in our most like human core that we deserve better than this. That is something that I do think a lot of people have been waking up to. And I would say that, like, perhaps in the wake of the Great Recession, that was kind of a major, you know, blowing open of that sort of mental block before, where, you know, I think it was more common before the recession to sort of have that kind of mindset, and a mindset I grew up with as a conservative, right? That, like, if you were unhappy, it was probably your fault, right? And you weren't working hard enough, you weren't doing enough, you weren't being enough. If all of those ended up being untrue, then maybe you were getting screwed over. So your job was to leave, right? Your job was to kind of carve a better path, because ultimately you were in charge of your own destiny. I think that that was a much more generalized feeling among workers before the Great Recession. It was also the kind of mentality that the fiction of the economy leading up to the recession encouraged, right? Because people still felt like they had the sort of, they felt like, you know, a pathway to a comfortable middle or upper middle class kind of existence was still possible. And I do think that more people after the Great Recession kind of came to the conclusion that that was largely an illusion, and that in fact the inordinate wealth of the ruling class was closing off those pathways to the rest of us being able to achieve that sort of American dream that my dad came to this country for, that so many people have spent their lives searching for, right? So it's all, there's a kind of a, I'm taking the scenic route, as I say, to kind of answer your question. But I think that this is all part of how I would answer it, right? I think that after the recession, more and more people had to learn how to feel okay with saying, I'm getting screwed over, right? And it's not my fault, right? Another conversation that I have for this book that's coming out is with a brilliant woman worker in Detroit named Courtney Smith, who like talks about the power of, you know, recovering from alcoholism, like having grown up in, you know, like a home that dealt with poverty, that dealt with kind of parents in prison and drug use and stuff like that. She talked about how powerful it was to finally acknowledge that it wasn't all her fault. Like, you know, who she was, how she was living, the pain she was feeling. And I know the very first episode of Working People that I ever did with my dad, Jesus Alvarez, after we had lost our house in the Great Recession, after we had lost everything, really, and we were all punishing ourselves so deeply with that pre-recession mindset, thinking that a global recession was all our fault. Like, everything that we lost, we could have kept from losing if we did something different, right? I feel like there were a few years where that was the case, and we were depressed as shit. You know, our family was really breaking apart. And that very first episode of Working People was one of my attempts that my siblings and I, you know, had tried to get our parents to talk about it. Instead of going to therapy, at least talk to us about it, talk through what's going on in your head, and ultimately come to that conclusion that, like, wow, like, maybe this wasn't all my fault. And the thing that opened that door up for my dad, and I apologize if I've told this story to anyone who's watching, but, you know, he, you know, doesn't go to therapy. This was not the kind of person that he was before the recession. It was not the kind of person he was, you know, in the years after the recession. And no matter how many times his children would kind of tell him that it wasn't his fault, that he should stop punishing himself, the first time that I started to notice that sink in was when he was driving for Uber to kind of pay bills, and he was talking to the people he was driving. And, you know, he was realizing that he was driving people who were his age, who had also lost their home. He was driving other immigrants, you know, who had lost their homes or who had lost their jobs or who were on their way to their second or third job. That was when he started to realize he wasn't alone. And that's when he started to feel a little more okay sharing what he had gone through. And therein is that kind of generative kind of core of why I felt, you know, like, you know, we've all seen the power of workers kind of talking shop, sharing horror stories over a cigarette and stuff like that. But this was something that kind of really crystallized that in a really powerful therapeutic way that allowed my dad to confront that trauma in a way that he hadn't yet. And I wanted to help kind of provide a space for that where workers could be open, could talk about their struggles, could feel that their stories were in conversation with, you know, the other stories that had been shared on the show, and kind of make it a sort of virtual break room where we could all be honest about the ways that capitalism was screwing us over. Right. And so circle back to the question. This, I think, has been a process over the past decade of people first realizing that the system and the promise of that system that really kind of coasted us through the Reagan years and the kind of end of the Cold War, right? That belief that American capitalism could really provide for all. I feel like that ran, that it took time for that to run out of steam. Then it took time for us to develop the language about who was at fault here, what the real structural issues were, and also to do that sort of personal reflection to acknowledge that, in fact, we were being wronged, that in order to kind of correct this sort of system, we needed to find one another once again. We needed to build that sort of solidarity. And in a country where the main vehicle for building that solidarity, for addressing those issues, i.e. the labor movement, had been battered so much for so long to the point that we're like at historic low union density. Mm-hmm. That's taken a long time, but I think we are now starting to see the fruits of that. And the pandemic did catalyze that process quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, that conversation, I had a similar one with my father. Like, we didn't have nearly the issues with like loss of house or anything like that, but still having a conversation in the last like 5 years of like, I'm having to work deep into my 60s. And I thought, like, you can't do it. You can't do what they say you should be able to do in this country. Mm-hmm. That's a profound conversation.
Yeah. I mean, it's in those kind of, I mean, that's happening, you know, more and more in like the, I don't know, like the expectations that our parents had, I think. At least most of them, you know, haven't been met because of changing dynamics. But I like to, you know, I think that, like, you know, talking about these things is really important. One, because I think in your dad's story, like sharing those experiences, you know, can really help, you know, deal with some of the guilt and like the psychological like trauma and stuff like that is sort of thrown at us. But it also gives us like a way out, you know. So I grew up in the South. I grew up poor in the South. I had, you know, I was a bit conservative in those days, and, you know, I'd worked, you know, all throughout my teenage years, but my first like real kind of, I mean, I shouldn't use the word real, but my adult job, was working concrete. Right. And I was working concrete as a young guy. I was the only white guy on the job, which was a really amazing experience for other reasons. But I started to realize very quickly, though, it's like, well, I'm getting brought in here because everyone else here has like 10, 12 years experience. And the guy we're working for was a real shit boss. No one else wanted to work for him. So they were trying to get in young people who would accept a lower wage than everybody else. Right. So, you know, I was being brought in to sort of break labor. I had no idea. Right. But anyways, it's like I had been working there for a little bit. And it was our first day, like doing a real big poor job, right? And when you do that, you have to have, you know, full equipment, boots, and all that kind of stuff, which I didn't have. You know, I was just wearing typical like work clothes. Some boss looks at me, says, you know, do you have like boots for, you know, for pouring concrete? It's like, no. He says, all right. He takes me to Walmart, and he like buys me all the equipment that I need, and he says, I'll take this out of your paycheck. And I came back to the site, and the guys came up to me and they said, hey, David, you know, did you
did you buy those? And I said, no, I didn't. The boss paid for them. He says, did he pay for them? Is he going to take them out of your paycheck? I said, he's going to take them out of my paycheck. And these guys, it was like a group of six folks. It was, you know, like five immigrant workers and another like older black South Carolinian man. They walked up to him and they said, we are not going to do this job. And, you know, if you're going to charge this kid for his equipment, you don't make me pay for the shovel. You don't make me pay for this. You know, why are you going to take advantage of this person, right? And they didn't have to do that or anything like that. And I don't tell the story, but like, I tell the story because for me, at least, it was a realization that like, oh, these are like my comrades. Like these are my people. Like we're on the same side. And they got that, you know, I didn't get charged for any of that equipment. And I don't know, it was like a really quick lesson in not only like what side are you on, but also when you stick together and we say we're going to withhold our labor, you can get a lot of shit done really quickly. They didn't have to convince him on any kind of moral level. They just said, we're not going to work. And I think that like what I think is encouraging about what we've been seeing over the past 2 months, just talking to people around where I grew up, is that there is becoming more, I think, awareness of what happens when, you know, people don't show up to work, or, you know, say they're going to refuse. And that's, I think, is the hope that is that it's going to be able to spread, because I don't know, being able to tell these stories and to make these things seem tangible rather than just sort of like abstract, I think is a really powerful tool in breaking the kind of power capital has over our minds.
I agree. So I wanted to check how much time do we have? Because that
as much as you got.
Okay, cool. Because I think it's a, you know, it's a powerful story and a really powerful point, right? Because this is something that, you know, I've talked about quite a bit on my show, Working People, with other workers, because I think that's another thing to really kind of remember here, right? You know, not to again, yeah, do the leftist poo-pooing sort of thing, but just to kind of, you know, make sure that we understand what it is that we're dealing with here. As I was kind of just saying on that kind of long-winded rant, right, the bare fact is that union density in this country is still at like practically an all-time mm-hmm. low, right? In the private sector, it's abysmal, right? But I mean, I think we're still hovering just above 10% nationally, right? That is a far cry from, you know, the amount of workers who used to be, or the percentage of workers in the U.S. workforce who used to be part of a union, right? And so for most people, this is something we talked about, you know, during the Bessemer drive and after the Bessemer drive was defeated, was I was like, you know, for most people, the concept of being in a union is entirely theoretical, mm-hmm. right? Because they've either never been in a union job, or, you know, their union jobs, if they actually had one, a lot of people have had bad experiences,
yeah.
right? And we're kind of seeing a sort of another encouraging thing is we are seeing kind of rank and file energy pushing to revamp the sort of structure of the labor movement so that it is more responsive to the rank and file's needs. And we may actually get a fucking crash course in that in 3 hours when, you know, over 10,000 John Deere workers
could go
on strike, right? And even next week, UAW members are going to be voting in a historic referendum about whether or not they can directly elect their top leaders in the union. That's incredible, right? But again, it signals that a lot of people, you know, who may have had union jobs may not have had good experiences with them, and that's something that we need to acknowledge. The hardest, I think, episode of Working People I ever did was one that we published last month, which was I couldn't interview the worker that we were talking about because he committed suicide. Oh, man, and sorry. Because this worker, Evan Seyfried, I was talking to his family. He was in the union, you know, and the union failed him, right? He was getting harassed and bullied by management, but when he tried to get, you know, his union steward to help, the union steward, like, kind of was friends with management, and they, you know, collaborated on this horrifying sort of campaign to bully and harass this poor guy who had worked there at Kroger for 20 years. He was a loving, caring person dedicated to his job. And no one was there for him. And he ultimately, you know, his family describes him experiencing a psychotic break and taking his own life. And that talking to his family about that was really, really hard, but it really showed the consequences of people not having your back at work. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, where I'm getting at, is that most people don't know what that feels like, mm-hmm. even whether it's in a union shop or a non-union shop. The vast majority of us have only ever known the sort of cutthroat, individualistic you know, either climbing our way up the ladder or staying out of, you know, the way of the boss in order to kind of get our paycheck and go home. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, those experiences when you have your coworkers stand up for you, even if you didn't ask for it, really stay with you clearly. Right. I mean, I've had similar experiences myself where folks kind of stood up for me and pointed out that I was getting screwed over in a way that I didn't even realize at the time. And so, you know, like that is ultimately like what we mean when we talk about the labor movement, when we talk about the importance of unions, it's actually having the experience that has been beaten out of so many of us, which is feeling like we are more than just ourselves at work. We are the kind of workforce, right? There is, you know, think about that mm-hmm. second, you know, word there. You know, we have force in the power of workers working collectively, but you cannot be a workforce as an individual worker, right? You need mm-hmm. to be the force of a collective there. And I feel like, again, to tie it back to the other point that we were talking about earlier, something that we've talked about with a lot of non-union workers on the show is that, like, I feel like for the vast majority of us, those kind of entry-level jobs, those non-union jobs typically, they're almost a type of sinister social engineering where, you know, new workers are educated in the experience of having complete powerlessness in the workplace, mm-hmm. right? It is a form of discipline, is a form of indoctrination, is a form of education where your main the main goal there, right, is to indoctrinate you into accepting that experience of having no power and no say over your working conditions. And so again, I think that this is the point that I wanted to get to. That's why, you know, like people seeing these worker struggles is so important. People mm-hmm. seeing, you know, like the rank and file militancy is so important. And we in the media have a role to play there to try to amplify that message, connect people to those struggles that they may not have seen otherwise because corporate media never fucking covers it. But here's the point that I wanted to make. So the brilliant labor organizer and you know, former co-host of the Valley Labor Report, David Story, our beloved comrade from Alabama, mm-hmm. made a really important point when we did like this working people listener, live listener hang session, where we had listeners kind of call in so that Jules and I could kind of talk with them and stuff. It was a lot of fun. But we talked about this. We talked about the great resignation. We talked about the quote unquote strike wave, what it meant, how much hope we should have for it. And David, you know, as he tends to do, made a very sobering point where he said, look, you know, like until I see otherwise, I'm going to worry that this is, you know, this is a historic moment where we are seeing historic levels of workers quit, where we are seeing historic levels of people realize in some level that they do deserve better. But in the absence of a strong and organized labor movement, the thing that people do, the one kind of tool that they have been using is leaving. Mm-hmm. And if you and so we have essentially been given the opportunity to vacate that battlefield instead of dig our heels in and push in our respective workplaces for better conditions for the next people mm-hmm. who walk in the door. So that is, again, a sign of, you know, the how far we still have to go to turn a moment like this, which may be a once in a generation kind of moment, into what it needs to be.
I mean, on that note, what do you, both of you, make of the, I guess, reactionary attempts to obfuscate what's exactly happening? We had a bunch of Southwest Airlines flights canceled over the weekend, and we had, like, Jack Posobiec and other folks saying that this was part of a strike wave, part of a strike against mask mandates. The unions have said no. Now, I think it's important to note that none of these right-wing figures noted a month or so ago when Southwest Airlines were suing because they were forced into a emergency time off policy by Southwest Airlines. How big of, oh, there we go. That's a big fluffy kitty. What do you make of like these attempts? And we can get the cat's answer.
No, what's up, buddy?
Oh, that's a beautiful mane. What do you make of like the right wing attempts to, I guess, obfuscate what's happening right now, or at least stick their oar in and maybe harvest some of the sentiment?
All right. So, David, I have a whole rant here, but since I just went on one, I'll let you take that one first.
Oh, I mean, I think the easiest thing is that the conservatives, they don't have like a proper or at least a appealing structural criticism or analysis right. of society. So they just try to fit things that can seem a little confusing to folks, right? And like, I mean, if you grow up in America, you grow up in a society of abundance that is like, you can see it. You don't always get to experience it. Do you know what I mean? Like you go to the store and the shelves are stocked. You might not be able to afford a lot of it, but for a lot of people, for example, seeing, you know, empty shelves was a very frightening moment for them. And in the same time, when you see any kind of like labor, I don't know, shortage, you know what I'm trying to say? Like whenever you see any kind of like interruption and things that you think, well, if I have the money and I pay for the service, I should just be able to get it. Right. You know, they're just going to come up with these kind of excuses up for it. And I think it is worthwhile though, because look, we can sit and be right all we want on the sidelines, like, but you know, don't let them, you know, it is worth confronting it because this stuff does permeate into like American, culture, you know, much more than I think sometimes some of us like are willing to admit. And so it's worthwhile to be there. You know, to try to confront them because they don't do it just because, you know, they're just throwing darts at a board. They do it because they know that the misinformation is helpful.
Yeah. I mean, I just want to jump in real quick there, like, and say, I think the absolute solidarity point is you have to protect your coworkers from getting a virus and do whatever you can. I want to throw something out. Maybe this is, I guess a scandalous or something, but like, If you're just generally speaking, if you have to leave your house to go serve a capitalist to live your life, if that all of a sudden requires a new vaccine, I think your boss should make that worth your time and effort mm-hmm. to get vaccinated. So I think like that should be the structural approach. And like the reactionaries that say this never go back to the part where you have to leave your house to during a pandemic to go serve a capitalist, right? Like they're not going to have that conversation, but so that you focus on like the other thing, but go on, Max.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think the points are both very well taken, right? As fucking dumb and bad faith as this kind of talking point is, that doesn't mean that it's not dangerous, right? And it doesn't mean that the kind of amplifying forces that are trying to force it down people's throats cannot mm-hmm. do real damage with it, which means we need to be all the more convicted and forceful in pushing against it, right? Because there are a couple things to point out here. Is like, one, this is, you know, the forces that have traditionally aligned themselves with the ruling class doing what they do best, which is trying to sow division amongst the working class. That is exactly what they're fucking doing here. That is the net result of what they are doing here. And we should call that out for what it is. They're not caring about workers. What they are trying to do is pick certain workers out of the group, segment them off, and convince them that they have less in common than they actually do, right? And so that's one kind of fucking point. Second point, kind of, which is maybe, you know, 1B of that first point, right, is Strikewave, great publication. I'm going to give a bunch of shout outs because I have another kind of point to make about the importance of independent mm-hmm. media with all mm-hmm. of this, right? But Strikewave does incredibly good work. They had a really good piece about how COVID vaccine mandates are a workplace safety issue, right? We're talking about this as like a question of individual worker choice and the protections thereof, like their right to refuse that vaccine. But as this kind of piece points out, it's like, well, if I'm a worker going into work and I'm surrounded by unvaccinated people, that is a workplace safety issue as well, right? So there's no one or the yep. other here, right? It's like, you know, you have to sort of pick a lane and stay consistent, right? And if we are trying to kind of protect the greatest amount of workers, the bare fact is that vaccine mandates work. And it's also, you know, another thing that really seems to get lost. You know, the forest gets lost from the trees when we're having this conversation is that the vast majority of workplaces that have mandated vaccines have seen like over 90% compliance. I'm not saying this is a non-issue because it is an issue, but like it's also, you know, something that a lot of the corporate media and the pundits therein aren't telling you, which is that a lot of these mandates have been effective. They have reduced kind of rates of people getting COVID. They have increased worker safety. And so like, that's kind of like, you know, the elephant in the room here. The other thing to point out, right, is from, if I hear anyone, I don't care even if they want to call themselves a so-called leftist, or whatever. Anyone who is kind of driving at this point, you know, like, it's worth asking them. It's like, okay, were you this fucking vocal for the past 2 years when workers were being asked to risk their lives for low pay? Were you this vocal when so many employers cut off their quote unquote hero pay like 2 weeks after they offered it, you know, a year and a half ago, right? That was life saving money for people who were doing life saving work that all of us were depending on. Were you raising as much of a stink about like their safety, their ability to, you know, their capacity for self-determination in those instances? No, a lot of it is being very selective. A lot of it is people who are trying to make their own point. And as always, they are using workers as pawns to make that point. This is a long running tradition in American politics and American media. We see it every fucking election cycle. Hamilton Nolan, I think, in these times had a great tweet. I don't know if it was about the pilots union, but it was someone who was involved in this who were rejecting the vaccine mandate. And Hamilton like tweeted something to the effect of like, this is a great example of how even people in the labor movement can be dipshits, right? I mean, like, we shouldn't romanticize the working class or anything like that. It's always going to be messy. There's always going to be kind of issues like this to work out, but we should always be incredibly wary of, you know, wolves in sheep's clothing who are kind of using their platforms to sort of inject these kind of pundit talking points that are really serving them and that are serving to divide the working class up.
Yeah, I think that that's exactly on point. And I mean, I'd like to get back in the last couple minutes, just because I do think that, like, maybe instead of sitting here and like prematurely declaring, you know, strike wave or, you know, we're at the barricades or anything like that, is to say that we have seen a couple of major shifts, right? If anything, since the Great Recession, I think there's been a shift in people thinking about income inequality, right? And realizing that there is a rigged game. But while that is good, I think that sometimes it has like come at the expense of people understanding or thinking about labor. And I mean, like, just like the fact that like working people, we keep the lights on, right? And what we've seen from COVID has been, as you're talking about, like hero pay and all these other things, is that every, you know, so many people have realized that they are quote unquote essential workers, right? That their labor, you know, despite the fact that they're, you know, they're paid low and they deal with all these kind of abuses and they're told by their bosses that they're expendable. I think more and more people are having the realization that like labor is critical, and even people who might not be laborers themselves are seeing this. I think that the kind of to go back to like what Story was saying, and I'm curious, you know, what you think about this, but like, I think this is the kind of difficult moment that we're in right now. Is like, I think there's sometimes on the left, especially like the younger socialist left, a kind of mistake of thinking that like everybody just needs to just sort of be like woken up from their slumber, right? And if you shake everybody up, then we're just going to be living in a new world. It's like, no, people have realized for a damn long time that they're being screwed, right? They might not use the same kind of terminology as you, but most people recognize that. And, you know, you see this when some people are calling for things like a general strike, right? Which, again, like I support in like theory, but it's like we're nowhere near close to being able to do that in practice, which is why this is a much more exciting thing to be supporting. I don't know. Like, I think that like, starting to move past just like recognition of a rigged game or even our power and starting to move into like organization and like structural power is the kind of shift that we really need to be seeing, so that we're not sitting here 10 years down the line being like, oh, do you remember like the fall of 2021? It was so beautiful. We were so young and strong.
Right. I'm glad that we ended up here, because I think it is very much where we need to end up. Right. Because, yeah, I, too, in theory, in, you know, I very much support the idea of a general strike. I have, you know, dreams about, you know, like workers kind of just all deciding to, as Big Bill Haywood said, put their hands in their pockets and bring the rest of the capitalist world to a halt. Mm-hmm. That would be fucking awesome. Right. And like you said, that is maybe point Z, and we are at point B, like between B and C somewhere. Right. There's a lot of work to be done. And if we are actually serious about seeing that result, then we need to dig in and commit ourselves to making those conditions possible for a general strike to happen, for a working class to become more conscious of itself and more organized among itself so that it can advocate its collective interests as a class, not as kind of a sort of divided up Republican Democrat thing, mm-hmm. not as like a state by state thing, or even a divided up by race. I mean, this is stuff that, you know, radicals and organizers have been saying for a long fucking time. So we better clue into that, because they were very much onto something. This is why I preach so often the importance of solidarity and understanding what solidarity means and how fragile it is. You know, who was it? Sarah Nelson famously said that solidarity is a force that's more powerful than gravity. I think that's very much true. But building it, mm-hmm. getting it to have that sort of strength in the first place, that takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of commitment. It takes a lot of tireless, unsung work that, frankly, we haven't done. And we have a long way to go to. And I think that this quote-unquote strike wave is a perfect testing ground for our capacity to build that solidarity. And I'll explain what I mean. Right. So, you know, I try to always tell people, as highfalutin and philosophical as I can be when I talk about, you know, what I believe the purpose of my show Working People is, or what I believe the purpose of the work we do at The Real News is, right? Like lifting up the voices and struggles of working people, of people in prison, of people who are under the boot of the, you know, police, right? There's something really important there, because the more of our common humanity we see in one another, the more that we hear those stories, like my dad hearing those stories mm-hmm. in the car when he was driving for Uber, the more that we identify with one another, the more that we feel in community with each other, and that we feel like we're actually more on the same side, and that there is someone above us who is screwing all of us over. That takes a lot of work, right? Any organizer will tell you that most of their job is just talking to people. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's not just talking at people, it's talking with people, and it's follow up. It's showing people that you are going to be there for them. And that is something that we all really need to work on. Right. Because for as excited as we all are about quote unquote Striketober, and there are reasons to be excited. Right. I kind of wrote some of these down just so like viewers and listeners could kind of get a handle on this. But like we said earlier, John Deere, a private sector company that has experienced record profits, upwards of $5.7 billion in the past year, over 10,000 workers may go out on strike at John Deere at midnight tonight. IATSE, the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, the people who make Hollywood happen, right? I interviewed some of them for Working People in The Real News. They are possibly going to be going on strike in a couple of days, right? I think it was like, you know, 60,000 of them with like 90% of eligible members casting ballots and overwhelmingly voted to approve the strike. That could be a huge strike as well. But here's the thing, at Kellogg's, mm-hmm. the cereal giant, right? We just had a great report at The Real News by Mel Burr, a wonderful journalist over there in Omaha who went to the picket line in Omaha, wrote a great report for that. 1,400 Kellogg cereal workers are on strike right now, not just in Omaha, but in Battle Creek, Michigan, Lancaster, PA, and Memphis, Tennessee. Carpenters in Seattle, 10,000 mm-hmm. of them just went on strike, right? There's a lot of strike activity. I think nurses, over 20,000 nurses at Kaiser Permanente just voted to authorize a strike. A lot happening. But here's the thing. A lot of workers have been on strike and are still on strike. And when I talk about the importance of like building solidarity up to the point that it has that strength that we know it can have, that means committing to the human beings who are involved in that struggle and not forgetting about them, right? Mm-hmm. Warrior Met coal miners with the United Mine Workers of America have been on strike, I think, for going on 8 months now, yeah. 1,100 of them. It was a big, you know, Kim Kelly heroically kind of pushed that story into public consciousness over the summer. She did incredible work, some of which we were honored to publish at The Real News. But now that, you know, the shiny new strikes are coming up, people are kind of forgetting about it. The mm-hmm. people, though, who are planning on how they're still going to buy presents for their kids in who work at Warrior Met Coal, who are wondering how they're going to buy presents for Christmas, they have not forgotten about it, right? Nurses at St. Vincent Hospital in Massachusetts have been on strike since March 8th, right? The company is trying to wait them out, and they have heroically like held the line for the vast majority of them. Over 400 union distillery workers in Bardstown, Kentucky have been on strike for, I think, 5 weeks now, and they're hurting. They need support from the strike fund because a lot of, you know, the UMWA is able to kind of support those miners, not just because it has a deeper strike fund, but because that local has done really well at building community support. Mm-hmm. That's not the case for a lot of folks. The Kellogg's workers, they're not getting much with their strike fund. So where I'm getting with all of this, right, is that if you want to talk about a general strike, and if in your mind you're imagining that these blue collar workers, whether they be miners or John Deere workers or entertainment workers, right, or teachers or hospital workers, if you're imagining this vast, diverse working class as being the engine driving that general strike, how are you going to get working people to go with you on that? How are working people going to trust one another enough if we can't even like show the kind of commitment it takes to see through, you know, a strike of 1,100 miners, strike of like 800 nurses, right? Yeah. That we don't forget about our fellow workers who are putting everything on the line just because a new strike has come up and we want to show everyone that like we see it and we're excited about it, right? There is a lot of, I think, deep commitment there that may be unsexy, and mm-hmm. that especially when you're in this media environment, it's hard. It's hard to get people to care, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I normally don't talk about this all that much because it makes me sound whiny, but you know, I've been doing working people for years. That's nowhere near as long as people like Michelle Chen and Sarah Jaffe and others have been on the labor beat. And yet, like, it is damn near impossible to get people to care about workers in general, let alone to care about them for more than a couple days, right? So we have a long way to go. And again, we need to kind of, there is work that all of us can do to train ourselves to care more, to be more committed, to follow up on these struggles, to keep them in public consciousness, and to not have the attention span of goldfish, right? To actually, because that's what the ruling class is ultimately most afraid of. This has become a political paradigm across the board, whether it's Mitch fucking McConnell or the bosses at St. Vincent Hospital. One of the most crucial kind of tactics that the ruling class and the interests that serve them have developed in the 21st century, you know, new media world is time, is weaponizing time. They know how short our attention spans are. And so their main weapon is to wait it out until people eventually stop caring. And then it becomes a lot easier to get what you want. This is happening in politics. It's happening in the workplace, right? And so we need to actively fight against that. And again, those of us in media, those of us with platforms have a real responsibility there to lift up other people's struggles, to be like transistors in this larger circuit, right? Where we can, you know, no one has to do everything, but everyone can do something. And together, mm-hmm. we can become this sort of amplifying force that puts people who may have felt isolated at their workplace, who may have felt like their only option was to leave. Suddenly they're seeing someone on Left Reckoning or hearing someone on Working People say, oh man, this guy was in a very similar position. He found a union, he got help, or he talked to his coworkers about how much they were getting paid and they did something about it. Again, we've lived in a ruling class dominated culture that has extinguished a lot of that. Mm-hmm. Now we are in a moment where we actually have more of the tools and more of the kind of means to amplify those messages, to put people in conversation with one another, to put these struggles in conversation with one another so that it can become the sort of wave that we hope it is, the class conscious wave that it needs to be, and that collectively we can do that sort of work so that the working class can be bound by the kind of solidarity it's going to need to tackle the forces that it is up against.
Yeah, I mean, I think you said it perfectly. And like the point of this is not to like come at anybody who has big aspirations, but it's actually to start the actual work of understanding what it would take to like meet those aspirations. And your work both at Working People's Bond and at the Real News Network is really critical to all that. I can't thank you enough for joining us this evening, and I'd love to be able to do it again soon sometime.
Anytime, guys. Oh, yeah. Next time, let's meet at the Working People feed, and we can do a crossover there, and then I'll see Grizz comes ass on the gridiron.
Yeah, good luck this weekend, man. I'm coming. My boy Derrick Henry is hungry. Let's go.
Jesus. Yeah, that's it. I got on David's ass because he vultured like three of my draft picks. But really, I mean, this guy is just riding the Yeti, Derrick Henry, like straight to a championship.
We'll see. I think you might have me this weekend, but we'll see, man. I appreciate it, brother.
Thanks, Rex.
Thanks, guys. It was great being here.
Yeah, talk to you soon.
And people got to check out his recent segment on pork factory farming, which, I mean, that I think it's super interesting. Like, talk about making people care. Like, that sort of thing, and I don't have experience with pork necessarily, but poultry, like sort of giant poultry plants. I remember driving down through Minnesota and you can smell those things like
it's tough work, man.
Miles and miles off. And just the different perspectives you get when you're actually talking to people in the community of how to like fight this stuff is invaluable. So people should go subscribe to that podcast and follow.
Yeah, we'll put the links and stuff in the description if they're not already down there.
Yep.
And that was really helpful.
All right. So let's move on to Russell Brand. Now, I am not somebody who is going to really go hard at Russell Brand. Russell Brand is very close to my heart. I'll just say I always thought he was well chosen for Mark Fisher's Exiting the Vampire Castle essay. And I don't really remember what he was in Hot Water at that time for, but I do know that that's how I heard of Mark Fisher. I was a Russell Brand fan at that time. I've started listening to his radio show in the late 2000s on BBC. There's maybe not anybody's voice I've listened to more than Russell. I've heard all those radio shows, not one time, but like 15 times maybe. It was just my like, you know, background listening. I think it's very funny guy. And also important in a way that he was probably the first major media figure that would call himself a communist. Now, I think he could do a little bit more studying. Just, but he's right and talking about he was interested to talk about Noam Chomsky, the Cuban Revolution. His interests, enthusiasms, I think, are defensible and should be applauded. I am standing up right now because Russell Brand, in part, I think, because I like the energy. When you stand up to talk into a mic, it's a different energy. That's how Russell Brand broadcasts. I have said before that when I started working with Michael Brooks, I consciously thought of myself as his Matt Morgan, who was Russell's sidekick on those radio shows. So I'm a big fan of Russ. And I think his heart is in the right place. I think his ears, for instance, on maybe certain vaccine stuff have been in the wrong place. We'll get into that a little bit later when it's more opportune. But I think one place his mouth was in the right place was this conversation with Brett and Heather Hein in episode 206 of his Under the Skin podcast, Evolution and Ideology with Heather Hein and Brett Weinstein. So if you want to share my screen,
David. Yes, sir.
We'll play a little bit of this here. So here's, I just want to play the beginning of this because Russ takes a little, Russell Brand is very interested in mythology and capitalism. Like he's a definite anti-capitalist and it's a theme he repeats very often. So he talks to Brett about this stuff and doesn't get a very good response. And we can go through why I think this response is a little bit revealing.
I'm not getting sound. I don't know.
Oh, no sound. Oh, let me. Sorry. Let me try one extra thing.
No worries. I hope it looks like the quality of this stream has been a lot higher than our other ones. So we're liking the new system, but there's still some kinks to work out. While Matt's doing that, I do have to correct the record in the chat that I'm not a Titans fan, but Derrick Henry is my number one fantasy running back. I'm a Dallas Cowboys guy all the way.
All right, so I shared a new tab. This one should work maybe a little bit better. And this is him setting up his conversation with Brett.
Of the book. And it's a pretty good conversation. I know, of course, you might have heard of Brett because of some more controversial conversations that he has in the online space. But this one we focus on his book that he wrote with Heather. In this bit of it, what do we talk about, Jen?
Myth and what constitutes a myth and if capitalism is a myth. Because you say capitalism is a myth, is our myth of our culture. And they say, no, it's not been around long enough.
I think I'm right. If you'd like to listen to the rest.
Okay, so I just thought that little comment was interesting because they really don't. Look, I've been on the record saying Brett and Heather are absolute charlatans that really don't have anything to offer. And I'll review their book in a second. David and I will get into it because David read the last chapter. I read all of it. But just to focus on this conversation here.
We are told.
Welcome to Russell Brand.
Under the Skin.
Everything that you're saying about myth suggests that it is an important myth as story, myth as guide, myth as template. It suggests that it's a sort of an important component, and like we don't, as I sort of say with like 12 step stuff, 12 steps with regard to recovery is like we have a program of recovery. Like it's there are abstract aspects, but there are concrete steps. You do this, you do this, you do this, you do this, you do this. And I say like you already have a program. You have a program before you come into the program of recovery. Your program is a sort of a set of beliefs, some conditioning, a set of behaviors that are sometimes almost automatically triggered. Someone says this to me, I'm going to respond in this way. Someone makes me feel like this, I'm going to respond by doing that. It's all like I'm on rails, you know, like it's predetermined, even if not in that way that's neurologically often described about the time lapse between decisions and actions and all that stuff. It just seems like de facto on rails, you know. And I feel like that the culture has a myth. The cultural myth that we live within now, at least my understanding, and I'm certainly willing to learn more, is that it's economically driven. That if there is a profit motive, then we can ignore other side effects, and that I would say that other ideals have been accrued in order to support that telos, like that from. You know, agriculture onwards. So this is good for this strata of society, but it's not really good for everybody. It's not good for everybody's diet to sort of have monocultures, but it is good for this group, and this group make all of the decisions, so it's good ultimately. And how do you feel about that announcement? Because it certainly wasn't a question.
Well, we make an argument in the book for a model of how the mythology that guides us comes about. It's an evolutionary process. And I think the way to describe it is through the following recognition. You cannot write a myth. It's never been done.
Okay, so I just want to stop there. That is just an absolutely ludicrous statement to make that has absolutely no relationship to just basically the study of myth, right? Mm-hmm. Mythology, you might call it. Because who gets to write a myth is actually extremely important when you're considering the history of this sort of stuff. So U.S. mythic tradition is one that is very interesting because it emerges after the printing press, right? So you have all these captivity narratives about basically don't go into the forest, we can't go there. That's early in colonial history. Then you develop something like the Daniel Boone myth. Daniel Boone was introduced to everybody in a pamphlet by a guy who wanted to encourage settlement to Kentucky. I think Nathaniel Filson's Kentucky. And literally the first four chapters are about like, oh, the river goes out through New Orleans, so that's going to be great for economics. The soil is this way, the land is this way. And by the way, here's how a badass would own this land. Here's an example of some guy who's been there, right? That's how America came to learn about Daniel Boone. So, and this is basically why Russ is exactly right to mention capitalism in the context of mythologies, because they've always been controlling, who gets to participate in myth, right? That's why folk tales become very interesting to the Brothers Grimm, is because those are stories that were constructed outside of this, right? By just the people talking to the people. And you think about like American history, right? Or Turtle Island, as it's called by the folks that were a participant in the print culture. And the way that we denigrate sort of Native American oral histories, mm-hmm. and basically look at like, well, if it's not written down, then I don't know what I would have to do with it. But I would use a modern example to maybe outline this a little bit further in a way that, with love and respect and genuine admiration for Russell Brand, I would look at this this healthcare situation we've been getting involved in. So there's a myth, and Brent and Heather get into this thing about whether a myth is true or not, and that's not really that important. Whether a myth is true or not doesn't really impact how much it changes the world. Christopher Columbus thought the world was smaller than it was, but he had enough imperial backing to get him on a boat and sail around the world and and everything that followed from that. He was wrong about that. And also, if a myth is true or true enough, say, for instance, healthcare capitalists are hoarding cures. That's something that's fair enough when you talk about IP with regards to the vaccines, right? We are very specifically not sharing knowledge about how that could create these vaccines more. But who is able to get on top of that myth? That myth about the bad pharma companies and use it to their own ends. Well, there's this article here, and I don't know if that won't show. Oh, let me. I have it in here. It's The Intercept, a network of right. I'm going to share my screen here. A network of right wing healthcare providers is making millions off hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin.
Jesus Christ.
And basically. Okay. America's frontline doctors, I'll just read it because it looks like there's some issue going on there. America's frontline doctors, a right-wing group founded last year to promote pro-Trump doctors during the coronavirus pandemic, is working in tandem with a small network of health companies to sow distrust in the COVID-19 vaccine, dupe tens of thousands of people into seeking effective treatments for the disease, and then sell consultations for millions of dollars worth of medications. Today, it indicates patients, like hundreds of thousands, have spent up to $15 million and potentially more on consultations combined. So these are the folks that are saying, oh, it's so cheap. That's why the man doesn't want to do it. Meanwhile, they're selling it to people and selling $90 consultations to folks. And then I don't know what really takes $90 an hour for consultations. I don't know what takes so long because basically consultation is like, yeah, we'll give you this. But actually, maybe what does take so long is the amount of disclaimers and you can't sue us language that you have to sign off on if you get a doctor to prescribe you this off message. Like, I don't have it up right now, but I'll put a thread in that shows, like, you have to sign off. And I want to contrast this with the anti-vax talking point against, like, how there's no liability against the vaccine providers. If you get the vaccine and you have a bad reaction to it, there is a government website already set up that will take care of you, right? It's called the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. It's already up here as the Health Resources and Services Association. You're fine. If something bad happens, if you're one of the very minuscule amount of people who has a bad reaction, you're good, but not with, you know, these ivermectin freaks. So anyway, that's just a demonstration of how a myth gets, why in capitalist society, you have to look at who's writing the myths, right? Let me go back to my Brett and Heather for a little bit more.
You got it.
You can jump in here if you want to.
No, I mean, I think that's, I mean, myth making is absolutely a critical power. I mean, that's why so much of, like, Marxist philosophy starts focusing on the question of, like, ideology, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the concepts that sort of govern the society around us are presented as if they're natural outcomes rather than purposeful, systems that were created with a certain goal in mind. So, you know, to say that you don't get to write this is an amazing lie, especially in the context of the United States. Because, I mean, the Daniel Boone story, I didn't know per se, but there's plenty of American stories that have the same kind of mentality, or even ones that are progressive. I mean, you know, one of my teachers when I was at school wrote their PhD on American folk songs during the Great Depression, right? And primarily think about songs like Big Rock, Candy Mountain, right? The myths that were being told, or the stories that were being told, were about what was, like, lacking in society, which was, like, food and, you know, basic things like that. And you can see that constantly, you know, showing itself in myth making. So I don't particularly follow what they're up to there. But let me get this up for you.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's also like you look at the way the Virgin Mary wasn't always such a huge part of Christianity. It basically served like Spanish Inquisition purposes, right? Like that's who got to write myths. Literally, Queen of Aragon or whatever the Spanish royalty was literally said, like, language is our power.
Like, well, I mean, no, I mean, like, on top of it, like, a big reason that, like, I don't mean to, you know, malign anyone's faith, but, like, one of a kind of bigger historical argument, you could read it in the People's History of the World about, like, Christianity's popularity was that, you know, folks, monotheism was becoming more and more of a popular idea amongst, like, the people. Right. But there were so many rites and traditions with being a Jewish person with Judaism. You know, people wanted like the monotheism and like that kind of like progressive ideology, but without having all these kind of rules and restrictions as to what they could do and couldn't do, which is like why, you know, certain aspects, especially in this early spread of Christianity, were sort of focused on and highlighted to make it a kind of popular like ideology. Because there's been plenty of other stories and plenty of other prophets throughout human history, but that one specifically highlighted things that were, you know, popular at the time for folks. I don't know. It's just like human history is filled with these things that, like, you know, these stories don't just fall from the moon, right? Like, it doesn't just like happen. Like, they're created in response to things that are going on around us.
Especially like even the holy books, like, right, these are constructed texts with like editing decisions being made by mankind. So yeah, I'll just play a little bit more of this. They go on. Where's my cursor at? There we go.
You can write a story, and then over time, selection modifies that. If the story is way off, right, it ceases to exist. It doesn't carry through time because those who listen to it do worse than those who don't. To the extent that it has value, that value gets shaped, and it can get shaped in many different ways. And so you have sectarian difference in all of the major belief systems. And those sectarian differences may be adapted to different realities on the ground, different habitats. They can be differences of opinion over which parts of the myth are important, and selection will sort out which group had it closest to right, because they will flourish. But the point is, it is not in any vague sense that these myths are playing this important role in guiding us. That is why we have a brain that takes on myths. That is why our mind focuses upon them. And what you're describing as the mythology of capitalism isn't a myth. It can't be a myth because it hasn't stood the test of time. This is all so new that we have no idea where the wisdom is. And
how long do you wait on that? Like 200, it's been at least like 200 years if you're going by like Hobbes Bobbs. Like, you're muted, by the way.
I mean, David. Plus, right?
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
The history of capitalism is up close to 400 years now. It's been a system that's been competing against other systems to become the dominant mode. But I mean, I don't know.
Well, I think there's an interesting way to talk about how they feed into one another. Why is it that, like, you know, we translate the Bible into Christianity or into English, at least all this revolutionary activity, but the sort of Puritan upper crust class, they really like to emphasize, isn't like the throwing over the money changers story, but it's the when God says don't take his shit, don't take his shit or it's over for you, right? Like what would a property class, like, what a great story for a property class to continue to push and push and push. But this idea that, like, I don't know, we're only like cooking the fucking planet to death, basically for profiteers, because we can't coordinate a response, because any sort of plan like that is controlled by capitalists. Like, I don't know at what point, like, because here's the thing about mythology. The only thing that matters about mythology is whether you can use it to empower yourself in a society that subscribes to that mythology. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if it's true or not. It doesn't matter, like this thing about, like, adaptivity. This is this whole other thing. Like, I think fairly clearly capitalism isn't terribly well adapted. When you look at all the problems we have going on and the terminal, like, barriers running up just in terms of physics and producing energy without like ruining the planet. Like, I think we're actually, like, if we're not into overtime, we're like at like 2 seconds left in the fourth quarter before we can start judging, you know, what the result is here.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, the clock is pretty late to be saying that we need some more time to be able to figure out, you know, the system. I mean, especially if your whole argument right there too. I don't know. It's just an, it's like the historicist like argument is sort of fascinating here too, where it's like, one, like we have the capability to break through the false and find the true. But two, we can't judge or know anything until like we're dead, right? Yeah. Until we're generations away from it. It's pretty incredible. I mean, obviously everything becomes very clear in the past, but also not so much either, because mythology is constantly, you know, altering the way that we view our history as well, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like we're, you know, we've done plenty of shows, you know, shows on this. I mean, Battle of Blair Mountain is a great example of this, right? You know, West Virginia and like the mantle that the working class has, like these kind of history and these kind of stories have been obscured and hidden, only to be reclaimed now, right? So like history is not even, frankly, like the best, like all these things are constantly contested, right? And it's kind of, I think, less so than saying necessarily that like, oh, it's hard to know or whatever. It's just like this kind of refusal to engage in like the actual hard work of like politics and philosophy is trying to be understand things as they are dynamic and happening around you. And also being able to understand the past with some hope of being able to have, you know, a better understanding of the future. I mean, this is like the process of like the social sciences. This is the process of like Marxism, right? As a science. I don't know. And like this kind of refusal to say like, I'm going to make grand pronouncements. I mean, we'll get into the book later, but like, I don't know, you know, to say like, I'm going to make grand pronouncements about the human beings and society, et cetera. But also I can't sit in judgment of today, right? Is completely, is absurd to me.
Yeah. Let's play a little bit more before we get into the book.
And this is the problem. We have to recognize that the novel stuff requires a kind of caution that things that are ancient do not. Now, in our circumstance, there's a different kind of caution that you have to use with things that are ancient. It may be things that were true, that led to human flourishing in the past, are now out of place, right? Things that were useful to believe may now be harmful. But these two kinds of precaution are very important in recognizing where we are. But at the very least, we should look at the central narrative surrounding things like what we're calling capitalism here and say, we don't know how that plays out. We don't know what happens when we reduce all of these functions to things that one can source a la carte in the market. Right, we don't know the answer, but we have reason to be concerned.
So that's what Brett's favorite thing is. He likes to bash markets, but not capitalism. This is the entirety of the book too. He'll say markets prey on this, markets prey on that. There's a bit in the corrective lens, which is how he ends every chapter, or they end every chapter. I don't want to be sexist. How Brother ends every chapter. That's in one of the final things. Says this is the corrective lens. How to give yourself a raise. And this is like the way that he uses markets, right? Explicitly aim to be an adult. Do this in part by regularly asking yourself the questions that are posed at the beginning of this chapter. Am I taking responsibility for my own actions? Am I being closed-minded? And by minimizing the effects of economic markets in your daily life. No explanation of how you just minimize markets in your own life. And there's another part where they say that you should... The market should not be allowed to intrude on several things, including but not limited to the love of sex, music, and humor. So, like, again, like this sort of weird anti-market thing, but there's no like concreteness to it at all. And I would just point to what he said there in this: novel things require more sort of hold back and see if there's maybe some hidden wisdom to capitalism that might, you know, justify it. At the final hour, right? And so he's got an interesting enough example of why we came to plant our fields at the exact same time as all of our neighbors, and that's so the animals can't harvest everything at the exact same time. They can only get some of it, right? So some of the harvest will get through. That's an interesting enough thing. It seems superstitious, but there's actually rationality to it. Now, I will just apply that and see how easy that is to use to rationalize bad things. So again, Heather has this section on what she calls sexual autism, which is where pornography is basically desensitizing us from personal connection. Now, whatever, I'll let the people who are experts in autism spectrum.
Can I just say really quick, because it is very funny. One, it's like, if you make a metaphor like that, people are going to be upset by it, right? Mm-hmm. And the funniest thing is in the text that you've shared with me, where they sort of line that out, like the first two paragraphs are basically them apologizing for using this term, right? So it's just sort of like, okay, I don't know. Like, as an editor, you're like, okay, if you have to do this much work, like defending against all these like attacks against you before you even get to your point, I don't know. Do another one. It's okay.
It's because they're edgelords, honestly. They're the most boring edgelords on Earth. But so we have this epidemic of pornography where people aren't having real connections. They also, in the exact same closing section, say women don't give away easy sex. And I would just say, like, what if the pornography thing is this hidden submerged wisdom that we shouldn't judge yet of people trying to deal with this easy sex problem? Exactly. We don't know. It's only been like 5 years since I could get 4K porn. So like, how do we know if it's really, maybe it's evolutionary adaptive, right? It's complete hokum. This whole frame of his, the book is this. It's like, open the chapter with something that makes you look like Indiana Jones because you went to the Amazon once. Some very strange stories we don't have time to get into. And then do this sort of like Joe Rogan bait about like maybe there's secret wisdom to this. But ultimately it's to package this like anti-porn, also women, you know, keep your panties up. And then it's like, I'd also say like maybe the porn thing is to help with Brett's weird fixation on growth. At the end, maybe not a weird fixation, but crowbarred in fixation that I don't really seem like vibes with the rest of the book, which is like, again, like it's Joe Rogan bait. It talks about psychedelics. It says, hey, you want to do something really good for yourself? Do more campfires and that stuff. This is a book for people who are intimidated by Richard Dawkins, Yuval Noah Harari, or Chris Rye in particular. I want to see a Chris Ryan review of this book, actually, mm-hmm. Given his. But anyway, that's my review of their book. I would say, Russell, if you want to talk to actual leftists, we might not do as well for the numbers, but
we'd make it good, man.
Yeah, Russell, we'd make
it good. Like that. I have plenty to talk to Russell about.
Oh, me too. I could go on for days.
Yeah, I mean, their whole shtick is funny to me. And I don't know, like, if we were going to do any more analysis of the book later, if you're planning that, or if
this do you have anything on his growth stuff that you want to tack on?
Well, I mean, so the last chapter of their book is sort of on what they call the fourth frontier. And I less so than focusing on, you know, the entire argument of the chapter, I wanted to note the way that it deals with, I don't know, social science, right? Which is something that they basically shoo. Let me see if I can find it right quick. They argue that, you know, humanity has like pushed toward like geographical frontiers, technological frontiers. And then there's a third one, which is basically frontiers that are stolen or taken from people. And like the defining characteristic of those is tyranny, right? Fair enough. And basically but it's because of our, like our desires, human beings, to grow. And now we're sort of at this new frontier where we're having to actually create a new kind of system, that isn't going to be growth, focused, but rather like maintaining itself. So they're basically are like a Malthusian kind of argument that there's too many folks, there's too many people. And we need to make sure the population doesn't explode, but also doesn't decline. And it's you know, it's one, it's nothing unique as a kind of typical Malthusian argument, other than just like a long metaphor about the Mayan folks, the Mayan people. I don't know why I keep saying folks so much. I'm trying to find it up right here. They have like the four rules of like society that we should be following. And they're pretty, here we go. The corrective lens, right?
Yes.
Favorite section. Damn, I don't have it up on, I have it up on a different computer, so I can't share it with y'all. But, you know, we need to learn how to use our own mental architecture for a better life. Keep markets as far away from your motivational structure as you can, right? So this is like the kind of very vague anti-capitalism, but it's like markets aren't anything concrete. It's just like, you know, don't eat McDonald's essentially, right? It's like kind of like liberal, like, oh, don't go to Walmart, but, you know, use the other, the nice...
It's like degenerate liberal stuff. It's those degenerate liberals are putting pornography all over it and confusing you. I think that's the distrust of markets, is that they're like too degenerate.
These are the individual. Let's get to the society wide. But they also note too that, you know, as Matt was saying, keep markets away from commerce, away from children. Right. Again, I'm not against keeping the market away from children, but it's this kind of like opt-out mentality that, you know, liberals in the Pacific Northwest very much like. But the society-wide, we should, like the Maya, invest in our surplus in public works. That's fine. Mm-hmm. Which make us anti-fragile? I don't know.
That's just borrowed from Taleb.
The second one is prototype, prototype, prototype. Let me just finish these. Move to a precautionary mindset. Such that we can learn to regulate our industries effectively, minimizing any negative externalities that they create, right?
But like, what doesn't cautionary say, like, don't? Like, I thought the whole thing was we can't judge capitalism yet. Like,
yeah, but we have to be prepared for anything. And also plan. And basically, so rather than like an actual, like, the thing that's funny about like, about their book and the argument that they're making there. One, what Brett was saying about some myths or some stories being useful at a certain time and not being useful later. It's like very Hegelian, right? This is like one of the key teachings of like Hegel, right? Which is that, like, you know, certain kind of values were dominant in certain times. I mean, we can learn some things from those societies, but also understand that these kind of like what would be good in a Roman society might not be good today, right? So that, like, I'm just saying, like, I'm putting on like my political philosophy hat to try to understand what he's saying, right? So there's a lot of Hegel in that. And then this one is like Machiavelli, in the sense that Machiavelli says like we need to be digging like ditches and dikes to prevent, like, to be able to control fortune as it comes, right? So basically, like, you can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it in some sense. That's what a move to a that's a prettier way of saying what Brett and Heather say, move to precautionary mindset, right? And then the last one, though, is prototype, prototype, prototype. And basically their argument is like this kind of, I don't know, every time I talk to like someone who's like, I don't know, a big believer in like the science ideology, which I would sort of categorize as something a little bit different from like being a scientist or being scientifically minded. But this kind of thing is like, oh, all these things have been sort of poisoned by like the, you know, the soft sciences or the humanities. I mean, we need the kind of hard scientists, right? Which is like, oh, we can just experiment different forms of society. And then like sooner or later through evolution, like one will beat out over the other, right? The problem with that kind of mindset, at least for developing like human societies, is that kind of conflict does not necessarily create the best outcomes for all. It creates the best outcomes for some, right? Which are that, like, if you are a capitalist, if you are somebody who is at the top of this society, you do not want to prototype, prototype, prototype. You want to maintain, right? And the violence that we see in our society is basically trying to stifle that from happening, right? Any kind of new forms or new kind of ways of organizing ourselves from happening. So the kind of precept of prototype, 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 if it were to like be truly like embodied by our society, would be too much of a threat to the powers, you know, that be, that they would squash it. And that's what they do. And in that, I'm saying like his kind of, I think the kind of way of saying like what we need to be doing is like running experiments is absurd, because, you know, you run an experiment in like a small part of society, they're very happy for you to do that. What really matters is who controls all the shit. And then once you start saying, oh, we want to start doing experiments on that, that's when the conflict starts, right? So the idea that that's some kind of like new model or like new idea that like try out new things and see what works, like maybe in the most abstracted sense, yeah, fine. But like as like a way of like trying to model political economy just won't happen because of all of the kind of evolutionary reasons that they like to highlight, right? Which is that, you know, there are people who have power and they're greedy and they want to maintain that power. I mean, it can be very simple in that way. I don't know. I find it to be very juvenile of a kind of prescription to our problems. It's just like, oh, the problem is that we're just not being creative enough and, like, you know, trying out new things. It's like, no, the problem is that a certain group of people have been able to take, and it is what happens when you completely abstract like reality and society and systems into these kind of like anecdote stories that is right. What populates the book.
And it's like that seems contradictory. Prototyping seems contradictory with the anti-growth mindset. Like, if we're done with growth, then we should also be done with prototyping. Just, we already have enough prototypes. I don't know.
Yeah, well, but it's, I mean, it's also like, and I think this is a really dangerous idea that needs to be hit as much as possible. Like, the idea that like society has grown to such an extent that we can't maintain our populations is an explicitly anti-human argument. Mm-hmm. They're not the only ones who make this argument. A lot of people understand it implicitly. Honestly, it's a part of our mythology right now. In the United States, that the problems that we're facing are created by, are just like, oh no, what an accident. We're having too many kids now and we can't like support ourselves. No, it's that a few people live lives of consumption that are completely out of whack with what we can safely produce. And they have interests that have been set up to prevent us from being able to produce in a way that is less damaging, right? We started this show talking about Shell and all of these different oil companies, right? Oil companies are dominant and the dominant mode of like energy production in the globe, not because they're the best, right? It's because a cartel has been able to take over those systems, and they use their power both within the market, right, within the economy, and also with their reach when it comes to politics to maintain that system. I mean, most people are probably familiar with like the ridiculous stories of, you know, public transportation systems being completely abandoned in the United States in the early 20th century at the behest of both oil companies and automobile manufacturers, right? Those are things that have very serious consequences for our society. And those are things that are deliberate, not natural. Those are choices being made, and they're being made to serve a very specific end goal, right? What I'm saying is that like the growth of like human population and our ability to feed people is not the damn problem. The problem is that the way that we're doing it is a way that unnecessarily is set up to just line the pockets of a few, right? And there's no amount of prototyping that will get you out of that power dynamic. Even right now, we're seeing with Shell and these, you know, fossil fuel companies, their attempts to try to capture new technologies like, yep, you know, like hydro and carbon sequestering, et cetera, right? Like they're trying to make sure that they can also be the dominant players in that, so that they control the way that we, you know, pursue other kinds of ways of like powering society, right? And I don't know. It's like any kind of dynamic where you're trying to like talk about human society, where you're ignoring power and profit motive, and you're talking about capitalism as if it's like markets, like, you know, markets are just like the space where like transactions are happening, right?
Yep.
what starts to matter is the people behind those markets themselves.
Is it too simplistic to say I like markets more than I like capitalism?
Yeah, I mean, like markets have existed before capitalism, and they probably will exist post-capitalism as well.
Right.
Right. Markets are just ways that we try to allocate goods. And, you know, some people are big market socialists. I'm not as much, but, you know, there are ways to like, yeah, the attachment of like the market as like a concept to capitalism. So this is why you have people who say things like capitalism has been with us for thousands of years. Like, no, capitalism is a very specific relation, like to social relation to production. and markets are something different. Markets are very critical in sort of directing capital and are critical for like our modern version of capitalism, but they are not capital and capitalism in and of themselves, if that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot, but I mean, you know, Matt and I are just so inspired by the high level ideas in A Hunter Gatherer's Guide to the 21st Century.
Well, look, I think this hunter gatherer is going to be done talking about the Brother Squad for a while. Because, look, Well, it was just boring book. It was really boring. Like, there's a lot of bullshit in there. Again, it falls apart. Like, there's no through line with, like, the big guy. Like, this is publishing. This is not, like, like, really good thinking. This is publishing. You need, like, a little hook idea, and that's Brett's thing with the, like the wisdom. But this is, like the way Malcolm Gladwell sells books or any of these sorts of hacks. And they're just doing it to put all the buzzwords in to get a Joe Rogan audience. And that's fundamentally, like, Russell wasn't doing this before he went independent of, like, the BBC stuff to the same extent. And I think it comes from appealing to basically a Joe Rogan type of audience or media environment, right? Like, by which I mean one easily played by right-wing bullshit. Mm-hmm. And lousy with corporate and reactionary plants. And I think Russell is not one of those people. I think he's genuinely, like, somebody whose heart's in the right place. And I personally, here at Left Reckoning, we're going to keep the door open for him.
Door is wide open, friend. All right, y'all. This has been a lot of fun. It was really great being able to hang out and talk with Max. Sorry, I'm trying to... I'm still learning this new system, but it was really great being able to talk with Max, and I'm hoping to be able to do more of that in the future. We're going to be going to the post game, so for all of y'all who are new here, you can get access to the post game by subscribing to patreon.com/leftreckoning, and we will post a link to the post game at YouTube in probably about 15-20 minutes from now, so just keep your eye out for that. And when you sign up on Patreon, you get access to the Discord, and that's where we take our question and answer section from. So subscribe, support the show. You'll get access to the post game and also all of our bonus episodes. Last week, we did a think tank, which was a hell of a lot of fun. We talked about China. We talked about how Matt reads, or I guess listens to, so many different books, along many, many other fun topics. So if you subscribe now, you get access to that and our entire back catalog. And we hope to see you on the other side.
Peace out.